Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm super excited about this week's very, very, very special episode, because I am joined by friend of the show and published author. You know him as the co-host of the Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers podcast, who has just published a book, Scored to Death, Conversations with Some of Horror's Greatest Composers, Mr. J. Blake Fischera. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you for coming on the show, and congratulations on the book. It is awesome.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
You are coming off of a signing at Dark Delicacies out in Burbank, correct?
I did. I took a whirlwind trip to the West Coast. I was there for about 48 hours, and I did a signing at Dark Delicacies with some special guests. Charles Bernstein, Harry Manfredini, Christopher Young, Alan Howarth, and Joseph Bishara all came out to support the book and me.
That is phenomenal. I was out in L.A. A couple of weeks ago, just visiting family and stuff, and made a pilgrimage out to Dark Delicacies because I knew that I wanted to go out there, and was at the counter checking out, and the woman was like, oh yeah, you know, we do signings, and you know, you can buy a book online, and we'll send it through the line, you can get it signed, and she handed me the sheet of upcoming signings, and I saw Scored to Death on there. I was like, holy shit, I know that guy! I felt famous by proxy. I was so excited for you to be doing a signing at Dark Delicacies, so that's awesome.
Yeah, it's back in April, I went out to the LA area, and to meet with the publisher, and also just to kind of meet some of these composers in person, and I was having dinner with Joseph Bishara and Harry Manfredini, and they were both like, have you been to Dark Delicacies yet? And I was like, no, what is it? And they're like, it's a bookstore and you need to do a signing there. So tell them that you have the book coming out and that you want to do a signing and that we're all going to come out and sign the book with you. And I did that. And then it just kind of came to fruition.
That is really, really, really cool. Well, so let's back way up, I guess, because I want to talk about the book and kind of how the whole thing came together. But I want to back up first. Were horror films kind of your first love, or was it like you just kind of got into a lot of this stuff you cover in the introduction of your book? But since we're doing an interview, hoping to get people to read the book and buy it, I figure we'll talk about some of this. Was it like you got into movies and then discovered horror, or was horror your gateway?
No, just movies in general, I kind of got into pretty young. And then for me, it was, I guess, the Star Wars movies, which really got me into the idea of loving cinema. You know, back in our youth, there was always the behind the scenes, and especially the makeup effects stuff, started to be shown a lot on cable, or like there was a release of the Star Wars trilogy that came out when I was young, that came with like a fourth tape, which was like From Star Wars to Jedi, The Making of a Saga.
Yeah.
And I remember on like HBO or Cinemax, there was always a making of Nightmare on Elm Street 4 that would get played all the time. And that would just showed you like all the special effects. And it was like, oh my gosh, like movie magic, you know, it was like looking behind the curtain at this amazing thing. And so those are the kinds of things that really got me to fall in love with film. That, and I don't know, just like films and cinema and going to the movies. This was just something that my parents always did for me and my brother, take us to the movies. And so then when I got into high school and we just, you know, my friends lived within walking distance of a video store. So we would go, I'd go to their place and then we would walk over to the video store. And I guess just, I think with a lot of teenagers, you know, horror was, I guess, taboo. So we started renting like a horror movie every week. And that's when kind of an interest in horror started in a very casual way. And then for some reason, well, actually, I know the reason. When I got to film school, I just completely fell in love with the genre in a very specific and like real way. And that was due to I always equate it to being like a perfect storm of things that just were like occurred at that time. I was going to school just outside of New York City. So a quick train ride to the city gave you access to all kinds of video stores and weird crap. And being in film school with a bunch of other people that loved cinema, you automatically start discussing films and what you've seen and what you haven't seen. So you get introduced to all these things that you've never seen before. And also a very important thing at that time was Joe Bob Briggs's Monster Vision on TNT. And just like all these things kind of came together in one semester, my first semester of film school. And I just absolutely fell in love with the genre. And also it was like I had very nostalgic things about the genre that I'd never really thought about. Like, for instance, my mother, I only ever remember my parents telling me I can't watch a movie one time. And for some reason, it was my mom said, you can't watch The Fly. David Cronenberg's The Fly.
Okay.
And then, I don't know, when I was in early junior high or something, I don't know. I don't remember exactly where my stepdad was. Like maybe he was away on business or he was visiting his family, like, you know, like up parts of his family. Or I just remember that like after midnight on like a Friday or Saturday night, I must have been like 10, 11, maybe 12 at the most. My mom comes to my bed. She wakes me up and she says, come downstairs. The Fly is on. And so I went downstairs and we didn't have cable. So it was like on whatever Fox affiliate channel, like the midnight movie with commercials and whatnot.
Right.
And I think she just was maybe too scared or freaked out to watch it by herself. So she, so she woke me up and asked me to come down and watch it. And so that's like a very like nostalgic memory for me. And I also remember we used to watch all kinds of horror television, like either Tales from the Crypt in reruns on Fox, or at that time Outer Limits had like a new show, and all that kind of stuff. So the horror thing had always been there for me, but like I didn't even really realize it until I got to college and really fell in love with the genre and then looked back and realized I had all these fond memories for horror movies and horror television that I, like I said, I'd never really thought about that way.
Right. I remember when we were kids, we would take like one trip every summer, and it was up to either Wisconsin or Missouri. And so it was like a 6 or 8 hour drive, and my parents wanted us to sleep the whole way because there were four kids. So in addition to drugging us with Dramamine, which they pretended was to deal with car sickness, and only in recent years has my mother admitted like, oh no, that was to knock you out. They would let us stay up as late as we wanted the night before the trip. So
yeah.
That was like when I discovered, you know, Chud and Night of the Creeps, and like a lot of it was probably on sort of edited for TV, like USA Network or whatever. But I saw so many horror movies that I probably shouldn't have that way. It was like once a summer, the floodgates were open and I was like, ooh, what am I going to find this year? Was there like a specific movie that you can think of when you got to college? Like, is there one where it was like, oh, it clicked into place?
Well, no. I mean, I kind of discuss it in the beginning of the book that in high school, there was a very specific movie that kind of did open up the floodgates for me in terms of the idea of horror music, but also horror movies. And it was In the Mouth of Madness by John Carpenter. And I remember we rented that, funny enough, probably literally on a Saturday night movie sleepover. In fact, I think it probably would have been like, I think it might have been like my birthday. And I had all my friends come over and we probably had a bucket of pizza, which is, you know, my mom always had this bucket of pizza.
What is a bucket of pizza? I don't know if I've heard that expression, a bucket of pizza.
I've explained it a couple times on the on our podcast. There used to be this there used to be this pizza place, not necessarily even near my house, but it kind of near where I went to school. It was called Mama's Pizza. When you bought a pizza there, it was this like gigantic, like square or rectangle pizza. And it was like thick. The crust was thick and it was like, but it was huge. Like it would take up like the whole back seat. It was just enormous. And so we would buy this thing on like a special, you know, there was like one night a week. It was like, I don't know, it was cheaper or whatever, you know, some special that a pizzeria had.
Right.
And so we'd have all this leftover pizza. And we had this at some point, probably for Halloween, my mom went to like BJ's or Costco or whatever the equivalent was, and bought like this giant thing of Junior Mints. So it was like this giant bucket with a top on it, but inside were all like the individually boxed Junior Mints. So after, you know, you give out the Junior Mints for Halloween or something, you had basically like this small spackle bucket, but it was small in comparison to a real spackle bucket, but it was a pretty big bucket.
Sure.
And so to, you know, the way moms do find weird things to store food in, she would end up like piling this pizza, you know, like cheese to cheese, crust to crust inside this bucket, this Junior Mints bucket. So it became this thing with my friends when they would come on, when my friends would come over, my mom would like pull out this bucket of pizza to feed us. And so it became a thing with my friends. We're like, oh yeah, we'll go over Blake's and we'll sleep over and we'll have a bucket of pizza. And so the bucket of pizza became a thing. And so, and on the Saturday Night Movie Sleepers Overs podcast, sometimes Dean and I forget to do it. But at the end, we try to like rate the movie. And he does like five out of five sleepover stars.
Right.
And I used to do out of five Mega Jolt Colas, but then we thought that, you know, that was weird to have like a brand. So we changed it for like my rating system is out of five buckets of pizza.
That is really fun.
But so there was this birthday sleepover or whatever. And my friends came over and we watched In the Mouth of Madness. And it like literally changed my life. You know, we used to make movies on VHS. We had like, I don't know, we made an obscene amount of movies with like our video camera. We were so nerdy in that way.
No, but I did the exact same thing, believe me.
When I got to film school and my friends at film school would see them, they were like in awe of them because they were like really kind of like complicated plot lines, but they were all improvisational. We had like a basic premise and then we'd go from there. And a lot of them, you know, this was the days of like Pulp Fiction and stuff. So it kind of started with like these crime or like heist movies. But the minute we watched, like the 5 minutes after we watched In the Mouth of Madness, we made our first horror movie. And the background music was like the credits of the videotape just like running over and over again.
Oh, pre-internet days when you couldn't just get any music you wanted. So you just had to.
Yeah. And so that was kind of the movie that really started, because then I'm very much the kind of guy, and I think a lot of kind of like obsessive collector types are, which is like once you kind of discover something, you want to know everything about it. So once I discovered that movie and discovered John Carpenter, and then I looked at like everything else John Carpenter had done, I had realized that like this guy had scored like some like really important movies to my upbringing, but I never knew it was like this one guy. And I remember seeing Christine, the Thing, and of course They Live, and Big Trouble in Little China was such a big thing for you know, like our generation as kids. And
well, and it's interesting too that like In the Mouth of Madness was the one that kind of hooked you, because that score is so kind of different from a lot of his earlier stuff. You know, that's where he really starts to bring in like rock stuff. I mean, he had done some of that obviously with Big Trouble in Little China or whatever, but like In the Mouth of Madness, he starts incorporating like some kind of heavier stuff. You know, I just rewatched Ghosts of Mars, and that's the one where he's working with like Buckethead and stuff, right? Yeah, like I wanted to like it more than I did. I was hoping like on this watch that I was going to be like, this is the undiscovered Carpenter movie. it's not.
Unfortunately, that one does not. That one does not get better with the viewings.
No. But I keep hoping that, like, because it seems like systematically each of his, you know, Prince of Darkness for a while was like the unloved great Carpenter movie, and then all of a sudden everyone's like, oh wait, Prince of Darkness is awesome, and then it was In the Mouth of Madness, and all of a sudden everyone's like, oh wait, In the Mouth of Madness is awesome. So I keep trying to figure out what the next one is going to be.
He's running out.
I don't think it's Ghosts of Mars, unfortunately.
Maybe vampires.
Yeah, maybe. All right. So you fall in love with horror, and is there a specific at that point? Is there a specific kind of subgenre that you are gravitating towards, or specific filmmakers, or is it just like give me all of it?
When I got into college, it was a little bit of a give me all of it type thing. But at that time, which is another part of the perfect storm that I was talking about earlier, is like Anchor Bay Entertainment was started releasing like all these deluxe VHS tapes of all these movies. And I had this book that I had, you know, that I bought when I was in high school, and I started getting into movies. And like I said, this was like, that was the time of like Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. So I had this book that was about Quentin Tarantino. But it was basically about like the films that Quentin Tarantino liked, and it had like these little blurbs of interviews where he would be talking about Sonny Chiba or, you know, John Carpenter's The Thing and all this stuff. And I remember there was this chapter about like Italian horror movies. And he talked about this movie where a zombie wrestles a shark underwater. And it just sounded like the most amazing thing ever. So on a trip to the city, likely with Dion, my co-host of Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers, we're in there used to be all these stores in New York City called Record Explosion. And they had just like huge, cheap, like video sections and CD sections and stuff. And I found this like new Anchor Bay widescreen clamshell box of Lucio Fulci's Zombie. And I'm looking at it, I'm reading the back. And I'm like, holy shit, this is that fucking movie with the guy that
wrestles. I totally remember this story from your zombie episode. I totally remember this story talking about the clamshell tape.
Yeah. So that was another thing that was part of like this perfect storm that was like all these things started getting released, like Bill Lustig's Maniac and George Romero's Martin and Larry Cohen's God Told Me To. So all these movies were now on VHS and like nice widescreen or like somewhat remastered copies. And these were all the first movies that I really started to fall in love with. And then being in film school, I started to find like the directors that I really gravitated towards. And so during my 4 years at film school, it was like John Carpenter was a big thing for me. David Cronenberg started to become a really big thing for me. And Dario Argento started to become a really big thing for me. And to this day, those are like three of my top like five favorite directors of all time.
Yeah.
Ever. You know, that those are loves that have now lasted like 20 years. But, so it was a little bit of just like being introduced and having access to all these things and then starting to find the things that I really loved in terms of filmmaker. Martin, I still love. It's probably my favorite Romero movie. I still love Maniac, and that's why I really wanted to interview Jay Chataway for the book, because I love that score so much. And God Told Me To is still probably my favorite Larry Cohen movie.
I just recently saw it for the first time maybe a year or two ago, and it spun my head around. Like, I did not know what to expect, and even not knowing what to expect, it was not what I expected.
You can't expect that.
No. I think I need to see it like four more times before I can even process it, but it was it's wild.
Yeah. I remember right when we got out of school, so this was like 2000, maybe like the Halloween of 2001 or 2002, Lincoln Center did a big horror thing, film program, and Carpenter came and showed The Thing and did a Q&A, and Larry Cohen came and did a Q&A after God told me to, and it was like the greatest thing. In fact, that Q&A, which I was at, I think is like a special feature on whatever the latest DVD special edition of God Told Me To is.
Oh, really?
But, yeah. I mean, I think it's like a really crappy, you know, like stationary camera version of it, but I think it's, I think that Q&A is actually on there. So then getting to see all the, you know, like I said, having access to like New York City and being able, now being able to see these movies like on the big, even though The Thing was a pretty beat up print, you know, it was all like pink.
Right.
But it started to kind of deteriorate and stuff, but it was still cool to obviously see it on the big screen with an audience and then to have Carpenter like answer questions after.
And at that point, was he like still kind of willing to, how do I say this? When I hear him interviewed now, his answers tend to be short. Although I thought, you know, the interview that you got with him in the book is really great. And you even kind of make mention of like, he was in a good mood and he was laughing and it was like a fun thing. Cause sometimes when I hear him interviewed now, he just seems over it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So at that point was he a little bit more like willing to open up and talk about stuff?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, who knows? I mean, one of the things I think like, you know, there's the people that are fans of John Carpenter's movies and then those like the John Carpenter fans. And I think the one of the things that the John Carpenter fans love about John Carpenter is that he just like does not give a
No, he does not.
About like anything. I remember there was this documentary that it might have been on Showtime, and it was hosted by Bruce Campbell, and it was called Masters of Horror. And that's why I think it must have been on Showtime, because I think that's how then that show kind of was like the next step. And it was this like feature length documentary where they just like had these little, you know, sections about various directors, and they get to the John Carpenter section and they're interviewing the late Wes Craven. And he's like, you know, my biggest thing about John, he's like, I remember we were at a Directors Guild meeting. And then when the meeting left, John just like put on his sunglasses, like lit up a cigarette, walked out to like a red convertible and just like peeled out of the park with like, you know, with like music blaring and stuff. He's like, that's John Carpenter. And, you know, I think it's one of the things we love about John Carpenter is that he just does not give a crap. And, but I think he's going to fly to New York to do a Q&A. I don't recall him being, in that specific one being, you know, particularly closed off or anything. But yeah, I mean, for me to interview him, one, for him to be such a big influence on me, and then to know the kind of interviews that he does, that's probably the interview that I was like most intimidated by. And as good as I feel as it turned, as well as I think it turned out, I wish I was like not as scared of him when I did it, because I feel like I could have got an even better interview out of him. I also got very lucky in that the first interview I did with him was like 6 months before he even announced the Lost Themes album. So when I interviewed him, the bulk of the interview with him was done at a time where like not a lot of people asked him about his music.
Right.
So he was much more forthcoming and I think interested in talking about it. Because then when I interviewed him just before the album came out, just because I was like, John, now I need to talk to you about the album because I need to stay as up to date as I can. By that time, he had done like literally hundreds of like little interviews for blogs and various things. And by that time, he was really over it.
Right.
Like I literally think he might have been playing a video game while he and I were talking.
Well, you know that all those hundreds of interviews, you know, consisted of him having to explain like, no, these weren't themes. Like Lost Themes is a fine title, but part of me wishes he had called it something else because there was so much confusion. Like, so wait, were these cues that you never use? And it's like, no, it's all new music, you know, just having to repeat that sound bite over and over again. Yeah. I'm sure.
I think that was a ploy by the record company. But, you know, even his interview, as great as I think it is, and I think it, in my book, I mean, not to pat myself on the back, but I do think it's probably like the definitive interview of him about his music.
Yeah.
He just doesn't, I don't know, he just doesn't have the ability, I think, to talk about it the way some of the other guys do, because like I say in the introduction to that chapter, it's like, it's literally an afterthought for him. Like if you were to ask him what he does for a living, he would never say he's like a film music composer.
Right.
I mean, maybe now he might say musician, cause that's what he's doing right now. But at the time, you know, like the music was literally like he shot the movie and then he would sit down and then do the music. So it literally was like this afterthought for the movie. So I just don't think he has the ability to really talk about the process the way that guys like Harry Manfredini and Christopher Young do, who are like classically trained in music and all this stuff. And like, that's their livelihood. Whereas Carpenter is very much, you know, also being like coming from an editing world from him, it's like, it's very much about feeling. Like he sits down and he just plays stuff, and what feels right is what sticks and what doesn't feel right. It's very improvisational for him. So as fun as the interview was, and like I say, like he and I, we actually shared a lot of laughs and stuff, and that was great. And as detailed as it is about his music, you know, it's a very different kind of interview than some of the other interviews of the book, just sheerly because, you know, he doesn't really consider himself that, even though he's probably as loved for that music now as he is the films almost.
Oh yeah, for sure. He's never really struck me as a particularly introspective guy. Even when it comes to talking about his films, he's always just kind of like, I don't know. Yeah, I did it. You know, like I put it in front of the camera. Like he's just so like John Ford, like, I don't know. They stood in front of the camera. They said the lines, I shot it. You know what I mean? Like he's just real straightforward about it and not necessarily interested in like analyzing his process, even when it comes to directing. So it makes sense maybe that, like you said, music even being almost secondary to him, he's going to be even less likely to kind of talk about it that way.
But with all that said, I mean, I don't want to downplay, you know, his contribution to the book and his interview, because I do think it's great. And if you're interested in hearing him talk about his music and working even with other composers like Ennio Morricone and Jack Nietzsche and stuff,
yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of really, you know, great stuff in there about
it. It's a great interview, and honestly, when I first looked at the lineup, I mean, I probably like audibly gasped. I was like, holy shit, he got Carpenter. Like I was really blown away by that. So that's awesome.
Yeah. Well, there really was like this part of me that's like, even though I had started the book already, I'd started doing interviews before I interviewed Carpenter. He wasn't the first interview I did. There was like this part of me that's like, if I don't interview John Carpenter, there's really no point in doing this book.
Right. Yeah.
And luckily it worked out.
So at what point, you know, you get into horror films, and again, you do cover some of this at the beginning of the book, but like, for the people listening, at what point does the music start to jump out at you? Because, and you mentioned this in at least one of the interviews, maybe a couple more, like we are now living in this weird renaissance of horror scores, whether it's because of kind of the vinyl boom and how so many of these scores are being put out as these, you know, deluxe vinyl editions, or because of people like Carpenter or Fabio Frizzi, people who are like touring with their music, horror scores are like more present than ever before, which makes the timing of this book like so, so great. So now I think, you know, there's a lot of people who are going to be turned on to this stuff because they're surrounded by it. But at what point did like specifically the music of horror films start to really jump out at you?
Just in general or in terms of like doing the book?
Prior to the book, just in like where do you first start to really develop the interest in the music before it occurs to you to like, ooh, I want to write a book about that?
Well, that was like in high school and then especially in college. I mean, I think film music for people that – I think film music for the people that grew up in the 80s and, I mean, most – you know, like I grew up mostly in the 90s. I mean, my formative years were in the 90s, but my youth was in the 80s.
Yeah.
I think anybody that kind of was gravitated towards film, even at a young age during that time, it was all John Williams. You know, it was everybody had a copy of Star Wars, you know, on vinyl in the house. And so probably my love for film music in general started really early. And I even mentioned it, I think, in the introduction of the book, is like my dad had like the tape to the Superman score.
Right, right, right.
And I made him put it on every time he got to the car. So it was John Williams. And then also that my dad, instilled like this kind of a very eclectic music taste. Like we would listen to classical music or film scores or whatever, jazz, Broadway show tunes and stuff. So there was always like, it was never weird for me to listen to that kind of stuff because it was always there. So as you get older, then it's like you buy like the Spielberg John Williams collection on CD and all that stuff. But then it was John Carpenter that's made me really start to realize the horror thing, because In the Mouth of Madness was the first horror score I ever bought.
Okay.
But then either I can't remember if it was Halloween or like a best of John Carpenter was the second, horror score I ever bought. And then when I got into film school and I started going through this thing where I was falling in love with horror films, specifically the Italian films, that music really stood out for me. And Fabio Frizzi's music for Fulci's movies was a big thing for me. And I remember I had a roommate and I went out at a horror convention in New York City. I bought this like limited edition CD that was like the score to Cannibal Ferox and Frizzi score for Lucio Fulci's Zombie. Mm-hmm. Was like the second half of the CD, and it was like actually like one of the producers or one of the people behind that CD was actually Sage Stallone's son, who was very into horror movies and into Lucio Fulci at the time. Unfortunately, I think he's now passed, but they put out this CD and it was like, I don't know, out of 666 copies or something like that. It was numbered, but there was this band called Rock Opera, like ROC Opera.
Okay.
And they did like a medley of like tribute music to Frizzi and that score. And it was part of it was them just redoing like a more modern rock take on the Frizzy stuff. And me and my roommate Dave, who coincidentally we became friends because of a mutual love of John Carpenter, in college, when you're in film school and you start meeting new people, everybody wants to know what you're into. And so right. They'd be like, oh, kind of stuff you into? And I'd be like, John Carpenter. And they'd be like, oh, well, you have to meet Dave. So I would hear this over and over again. And finally, somebody was like, you know that guy Dave everybody tells you need to meet? That's him. And they pointed to this guy. And I walked over and I was like, I hear you like John Carpenter. And he laughed. And like we've been, you know, he's been one of my best friends ever since. But we would like sit in our dorm. We roomed together at one point in college. And we would like sit in our room and like play air guitar and air drums to like this Fulci tribute music. You know, like fake keyboards. Like we were doing the whole show. We had like a whole show going. And he had a mutual love, even more than me, for John Carpenter's music. I mean, he just grew up obsessed with it. And so I had the great fortune of being able to see John Carpenter live with Dave in D.C. at the beginning of July. And it was like a real thrill for us together being able to see him live. So it was like that music. And then, of course, starting to fall in love with Dario Argento was the music of Goblin.
Yeah.
And it just like the music of Goblin just like really rocked my world. And I just like completely fell in love with it. And then in like 99 or 2000, Claudio Simonetti, who was like the main keyboard player for Goblin, he formed some other band called Daimonia, where they did like rock versions, arrangements of all this stuff from John Carpenter. I mean, from Dario Argento's movie. And I just like, I was obsessed with that CD. And also around that time, Goblin got back together to do the score for Dario Argento's Sleepless. So it was like all those things were happening. And I just got completely obsessed with it. And so it was all like that synth based stuff, Carpenter and Frizzy and Goblin, that was like started my love for that kind of music.
Yeah. Did you go see Goblin when they were touring recently? The last couple of years. It was a couple of years ago, I think. But
yeah, it was like 2013. I actually saw them twice, two different lineups. And the first show was really what they were calling the New Goblin lineup. They were called New Goblin. But because I already had – they had that Live from Rome CD, and I had it. I bought it, like imported it, you know, paid a fortune to get it. And it was basically like half of Daimonia, which was Simonetti's band, and then half of Goblin. But they played all the Goblin songs in the traditional Goblin arrangements. And so, yeah, I went and I saw that lineup very close to Halloween. And the guy Dave I've been talking about, his twin brother Steve went with me to that show. And that show did two things for me. It, one, I became even probably more than ever absolutely obsessed with Goblin. I mean, because my prior obsession with that kind of music and Goblin and stuff, that was like in 2000 2001. So now this is 2013. So like, sure, I would listen to it sometimes, but it was not like the only thing I listened to anymore.
Right.
But that was all over when I saw this show. Like, I saw that show, and up until, I don't know, up until John Carpenter's albums came out, it was probably Goblin or something Goblin related was probably the like 90% of what I listened to for like 3 years.
Do you have a later on I want to ask you like favorite films and favorite pieces of music from a lot of these composers, but let me just jump ahead. Do you have a favorite Goblin score or even a favorite piece of music from them?
That's obviously a tough one.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously I think everybody gravitates towards the Suspiria score, but I really loved the Deep Red score.
Yeah.
Especially the main theme. I think that was like what I really initially connected with. It's of course it's very reminiscent of a lot of other things, but that was when I heard that. That was like the thing that was like, okay, like I can be into this band in a very like into being like as you would be into a band, you know. There's this, you listen to film music in a different way than you would listen to pop music or rock music. But like that piece of music was like, oh, like this is a band creating music for a movie. And so like I connected with it in more of like a musical way apart from the movie than I do a lot of other horror film music. So that piece of music specifically, I love. But past that, I actually love the stuff that they did that wasn't for a movie, like the album Roller. Like it's like one of my favorite albums of all time. I mean, it's very reminiscent. It's right after they did Deep Red. So a lot of it sounds very much like Deep Red, but they didn't do it for a movie. So it has a very different, there's a different vibe. I mean, it's not quite as repetitious as the film music they did was, but, there's stuff for Dawn of the Dead is great. I mean, it's definitely more, that stuff is more rock oriented, so I can get into that stuff. So those are the things. And later on I ended up kind of discovering the stuff that they did not for Argento, and even without Simonetti, like the Boyo Omega and the stuff where it was just like the bass player Fabio Pignatelli and Maurizio Guarini, and that stuff's great too. But it does have a very different vibe than that early Goblin stuff.
My knowledge of them is pretty much just limited to their film scores. And, I have like in my car, I just have like a mix of stuff that I'll play, and some of it's full scores and sometimes it's just pieces of music. So I'll be driving around with my kids and they'll be with it. Like, to a point, I can play the theme from Suspiria and they'll be all right until it gets into the, like, the wow, 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 wow. And they're like, Dad, what is this? Or like Deep Red, the theme. They're like, okay, okay. And then it gets into like the crazy, like, acid jazz part. And they're like, what is this? Like, quiet kids. Yeah, yeah. Daddy's trying to listen to Deep Red. Yeah. So, but again, I, and this is so well documented, unfortunately, on our site, but I'm so late to Italian horror. Like, I'm almost jealous hearing you talk about it, like, that you were exposed to it and pretty much got it right away. 'Cause boy, it took me a long time. I was watching stuff. I'm like, man, what is this? Like, I cannot. And then I can't think of the movie where it clicked. I honestly think, for as fucked up as this sounds, it was The New York Ripper.
Oh, I love that movie.
Right? But, like, that shouldn't be the movie where I'm like, oh, I get it. But for whatever reason, I was watching that. I was like, wait a second. I love this. And then since then, I've just been all in on Italian stuff. So I'm still playing catch up on a lot of stuff.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Well, it's funny. I taught a Dion and I went to my co-host of Saturday Night Movie Sleepers. We went to film school at a place called SUNY Purchase, which at the time was probably like, it was like the only undergraduate film conservatory, and it probably was the best undergraduate film program in the country. You know, that was at a time when we still shot film and edited on flatbeds and all that stuff. And but I went back several years later and ended up teaching a class to liberal arts students and continuing education students about the history of horror movies. And when I would get to the Italian stuff, and specifically Dario Argento, I would just have to preface it with, like, some of you are going to watch this and get it, and it's going to connect with you in a way, and you might not understand the movie itself. You might not understand what's going on, but it'll, like, connect with you on some level and you'll like it. And then some of you, it just won't connect with you and you just won't like it. And that's okay. Like, Dario Argento is one of those guys where it's like, there's no real in between. You either like it or you don't like it. And there's nobody that's like, oh yeah, Argento, he's okay. You know, it's either like, I don't care for Dario Argento's movies, or I really don't like Dario Argento movies, or I love Dario Argento. So, I was very lucky in that it clicked. It just clicked. I think maybe the first ones I saw, oddly enough, weren't even like the big ones. I saw like an American cut of opera called Terror at the Opera from like a $3 VHS bin at like Coconuts Music or something like that.
Wow.
And then a friend of mine at the time, Chris and I, we went to like the local video store and rented Two Evil Eyes, which was like this co-project that he did with George Romero. And to this day, as like, I'm sure a lot of Argento fans would be like, oh, like Two Evil Eyes. I just love his half of Two Evil Eyes. It's just so weird. And Harvey Keitel seems like he's drunk through the entire thing. And it's just like, it's the most bizarre performance since like Michael Moriarty in Q the Winged Serpent. And it's just like, I'm just absolutely in love with it. It's so strange. And I think that's the thing that, like, to me, it's like, you know, I would say to this, my students, when we watched, you know, Suspiria, or it's like, you know, like what's actually going on in this is not that important. Like, you have to embrace it for like this visceral experience. And if you just let a Dario Argento movie like just wash over you for what it is, like you just have to, you can't watch it in the way that you would watch a regular movie, unfortunately. And I think some of that's like, you could say that's like making excuses for it, but I do think that that's the way you need to watch it. Like, you can't watch Suspiria and be like, wait, what's going on? What's he doing? What's Susie Banyan up to? It's like, you just have to let the music and the colors and everything just like really just like wash over you in this very odd way. And if you just like surrender yourself to it, like, you can just like be a part of it in this way that you can't do that with a lot of other movies. So it's like, and I just, I, you know, I'm just willing to go. I'm willing to go with them, even on the really bad ones.
What is Argento's last great movie?
I actually think Sleepless, which he did in 2000, is really great. I think it's underrated. I don't think a lot of people give it a lot of credit because it was so late, but I think it's pretty good. And I think Goblin's score for it is great. So I think a lot of people would say Stendhal Syndrome or even Opera, but I like Sleepless or the Italian title Non Ho Sonno, but I stand by that one.
I haven't seen Sleepless. That is that one of the ones that he was doing like for TV, or did that come later?
No, it might have been around the same time. I can't think of when, like, Do You Like Hitchcock came out. Right,
okay.
But it was around that time. I don't know I can't remember which one came first, but it was that movie. And the other movie that I love a lot that I think a lot of people don't either haven't seen or don't like is Trauma. Because I think that was like one of the movies, that was like one of the two things he did here in America. And I actually think that movie's great. It's so fucked up. and there's the young Ossie Argento, you know, and a great cast. I mean, you got Brad Dourif and a lot of really great actors in that one too.
It made me happy to see, and I mean, it makes sense, but going through the book, like a lot of kind of Italian composers or composers who did scores for Italian horror are represented. And I'm sure some of that just has to do with your kind of affinity for Italian horror, but also because those films, I would say even more than maybe a lot of American horror films, like the scores are so kind of vital to what makes those movies the experiences that you're talking about, this thing that has to wash over you. You know, it's so much about the score. And so I thought that was really cool that so many of them are represented in the book.
Yeah, well, you know, obviously it stems from, as you kind of said, like my love for it. I mean, right. Claudio Simonetti was one of those guys where really, like Carpenter, it was like, you know, like I said, like if I don't get Carpenter, this book's not worth doing. Claudio Simonetti was almost that important to me for this. One, because there just isn't that much about Goblin and that stuff here, like information wise, because it's Italian. You know, these guys, you know, these are movies that were made decades ago in another country, and so though in the last couple of decades or so, like, we've started to get like the music and the films themselves, we still don't get a lot of information about them in the grand scheme of things. So it was really important to me. And the other thing, you know, you asked about seeing Goblin live, and seeing the Goblin live, the other important thing besides starting a new fascination and obsession with the music of Goblin was that's really where the inspiration for the book came from, was seeing that show. And, realizing that a band from the 70s that's still, you know, pretty obscure to the general public, whose heyday was 70s, maybe early 80s at the latest, can sell out venues all over the world now, which they could never have done before, even in their heyday.
Right.
So it was like this realization that, like, I'm not the only one that loves this. You know, I'm looking at a sold out audience in New York City right now, and there's other people that love this. And so I say it's the inspiration to write the book, but in the way that, like, it got me thinking about horror music and an audience for it, and like, what do we really know about it, and wanting to learn more about it, and then discovering that the kind of book that I wanted to read didn't exist, which was an interview-based book about the process and the importance of music and horror movies from the mouths of the composers.
Right.
And I couldn't find it. So I just decided to go for it myself.
And how do you... Really,
go ahead.
how do you start kind of I mean, obviously there's some, like you said, Simonetti or John Carpenter, there's some that right away you're like, okay, I know I want to at least try for these people, but how do you kind of start to generate the list of who you want to talk to?
Well, for me, and I think it's the one thing I've never kind of stated in any of the other kind of promotional interviews or podcasts that I did.
Wait a second, you've done other promotion for this?
Or even in the book itself, the thing that I've never really stated was like it to say that like this didn't exist and I decided to do it could sound absolutely crazy. But I've written for websites and I've done like many interviews for other things. And I've interviewed a lot of musicians for various websites and stuff. So like the idea of just like saying, I'm going to set up interviews and talk to these people. I think I was less intimidated in the idea of doing it because I've done it before.
Sure.
Had I not had experience, you know, interviewing guys like Leslie West from Mountain or Steve Cropper, like the great rhythm guitar player, rhythm blues of all time, or even Bruce Campbell, or guys like that. Had I not already done that before, I don't know if I would have kind of had the balls to try to do something like this. And even though I had done that, there was this big fear that as much as I would love to do this, am I the right guy to do this? Because the kinds of books that I was reading about film music in general, because a book like this about horror music didn't exist, but there were interview-based books about with just film music composers, not specific to horror, is that a lot of them were kind of, you know, pretty heavy on music theory and stuff. Mm-hmm. And although I am I'm a musician, but I'm kind of a self-taught musician. So like my understanding of music theory is very limited. And that's probably even like an exaggeration in terms of like how much I know. So there was this process of like, I'd love to do it, but I don't know if I can. And then it was talking with Dave, who I mentioned earlier, my mm-hmm. friend who loves Carpenter, about it. Cause there was a big part of me that was like, if anybody would read this book, it would be Dave. So let me talk to Dave about it because he would love to read a book like this. And it was like it kind of came clear that like, you know, like I wouldn't want to read a book about, you know, that was heavy on music theory because I don't speak that language. So just try to do it, you know, write the book that I would want to read and not be so intimidated by all that stuff. So then the next process was, okay, I'll try to set up a couple of interviews and I'll see how they go. And if I feel like they turned out pretty well, then I'll proceed with the book. And if I feel like I'm really not the guy to do this, you know, no harm done. Unfortunately, a couple of composers gave me a half hour to an hour of their time or whatever. And maybe I'll print them, I'll transcribe them and put them on the Saturday Night Movie Sleeper website or something as an interview. But then thinking that a lot of people would say no, I asked like a bunch of people thinking that maybe I'll get one or two out of this like first like burst of emails that I send out, and everybody said yes. So it was like all of a sudden I have all these interviews lined up. So it was like, I guess I'm doing this. Because even the ones that like didn't get fully lined up, like Joseph Bashar, for instance, who did the Conjuring movies and scored the Insidious movies and stuff like that. I didn't actually end up interviewing till like almost actually over a year later. But he was on board from like the minute he got the email. He's like, I'm into it. I want to do it. It sounds amazing. Like, but I'm in the middle of scoring like the Conjuring 2 or, you know, that time it was earlier movies. It was probably one of the Insidious movies. So there was a lot of interest from them to do it. The question, which is – this is obviously a major like roundabout way of getting to it. But in terms of how I decided who I wanted to interview, of course, the first part was, you know whose music do I love? You know, like Carpenter, Simonetti, Frizzy. Like those guys were kind of no-brainers because yeah. – of like my obsession with their music specifically. And then the kind of like the second process was like, well, what other films, one, are like iconic, and two, have iconic scores? So then it was like starting to think about that in a more, you know, in a very like really examine that and kind of think about it. The third step was I really didn't want to talk to anybody whose music I didn't like. You know, not that I can think of anybody off the top of my head, a composer that I don't, that I would say I don't like their music, but I really wanted to talk to people whose music I thought was really significant and to the films and to the horror film music world. And then the last step was looking at who I was asking and then trying to make sure that I was filling the other slots with diversity. Making sure I got some of the, you know, the more contemporary guys. That wasn't all guys whose, you know, career started in the 70s. Right. But I wanted guys whose career started in the 90s. Or a guy like Jeff Grace, who he scores all of Ty West's movies and works a lot with Glass Eye Picks, which is a very different kind of working as Joseph Bishara, who's doing the Blumhouse movies. You know, it's a very different kind of independent, you know, thing. So I wanted to make sure I got differences in ages, differences in experience, differences in music styles. So diversity was a big thing, because I didn't want every interview to kind of read the same. I wanted to kind of cover a vast, you know, look at that, this kind of subgenre of music as I could. Well, I mean, go ahead.
Well, that was one of the things that really struck me is reading through the interviews. The longer I went, the more I kind of started to expect an overall picture to begin to form. Like, okay, this is kind of how it goes, and these are how these scores come together. But every single interview, everyone has a completely different process. Everyone has a completely – some people love to use temp – or, you know, not love to use temp scores, but, like, are fine using temp scores. Some people won't do it at all. Everyone's kind of inspired by different things. So it was, like, very, very different approaches and processes. And so then the overall picture for me as I'm reading it is, like, oh, there is no – commonality, really. I mean, there are threads kind of throughout, but I thought that made it an even more fascinating read, because like you said, it's not like reading the same, oh, first I do this, then I do this, then I do this, over and over again. Each time you get to a new chapter or a new composer, it's like starting from scratch, and you're like, oh, okay, now I have to see how this person builds it from the ground up, you know. Or even the Alan Howarth chapter interview, I was so grateful for, because I finally understood how he worked with Carpenter. Like, for years, you just see that credit, just like John Carpenter, you know, with Alan Howarth, or contributions from Alan Howarth, and you're like, how does that work? What does that mean? And so finally reading him explain, like, well, here's how we worked together, was the first time that really made sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there is a lot of common ground for a lot of them, especially the guys that are working with orchestras, because there's just certain things that they need to do. And in a lot of ways, they think the same way. And I do ask a lot of the same questions of everybody. But you're right. There's enough differences between them that I think it does make for an interesting read throughout. And my publisher was really kind of – that's the thing he kind of loved about it was and also the lengths are different. Like, as great as Charles Bernstein's interview is, I think his interview is like he's just really informative, and he's very well spoken and very well thought out about the process. He's very clear, and I think it's great. But his interview is significantly shorter than guys like Harry Manfredini and Chris Young, or even Alan Howarth. So the lengths are all different too. There's enough differences going on that I hope that the reader doesn't kind of get bored by, like, he's asking this question again, because they're all different and they're all really kind of fascinating guys. All I had to do was just ask them to talk, and just like, and they were just full of gold,
yeah.
You know, interview-wise.
Well, and it's interesting too to read, because I'm somebody who, you know, appreciates music or appreciates film scores, but my brain doesn't work that way. I mean, they're describing a process or even an ability that just is so foreign to me. You know, I can watch a film and I understand how that is put together much more than I understand how someone could just sit down and start writing music, you know? And so I thought that was really cool. And like you said, it's not a bunch of music theory, but just even in terms of like Joe Bishara talking about, you know, the different sounds that he uses and incorporates. I'm just like, how does that even occur to you? You know what I mean? Like I would just a guitar and a keyboard and I'm out, you know, and they're using all these crazy sounds and landscapes. And, all that stuff was super interesting to me.
Yeah. I mean, really some of them, the way they describe it, it sounds like, you know, a superpower or something. Like
yeah.
They should in the X-Men or something, you know, like they could, you know, specifically him. I think he talks about speaking about one of the James Wan movies with James Wan and just as they're talking, he starts hearing it. Like he starts hearing what's going to inevitably be the final product while they're discussing it. Like he hasn't even read the script or anything. He's just telling him about the movie and he starts hearing what instruments he's going to use. It's really a fascinating process. And I've always heard about that from kind of more pop oriented guys. Like, you know, like for instance, you know, Paul McCartney waking up from a dream and having like the music to like Yesterday in his head, or, you know, Elton John talks about how he just like always has music going. And so then it's just like Bernie Taupin like writes lyrics and then he just picks like what piece of music is playing in his head that day and he applies it to those lyrics. So you like hear about these genius moments for these, you know, uber talented musicians. But then when you hear about like, you know, Chris Young describes it very much like for a film composer, it's like you start playing images for me and I start hearing music.
Yeah.
I mean, it is some kind of crazy like sixth sense or something that some of them have.
I guess this is what it's like to be inside the brain of someone who is talented, and I don't have that, so I don't have that going on in my head all the time. Where I'm like, ooh, I just need an outlet to get this out. It's like there's just wind blowing through my head until I'm asked to make a decision of, you know, red or blue. I don't know, blue, I guess. Okay, great, and then back to nothing.
You don't wake up with like the next episode of
this movie. Right. Here's what I'll say on the next podcast. It's just flowing through me at all times.
And JB's gonna say this. It'll be amazing.
I was super surprised to read also. I wanna say it was Jeff Grace. I was just rereading it this afternoon. I think it's Jeff Grace. He does the Jim Mickle movies, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was talking about his score for Cold in July, and that he just kind of wrote it on a piano, and then they switched it to synthesizer, and all of a sudden it sounds like Carpenter, and he's like, "Well, that's not it's not how I wrote it." But I mean, when I watched that movie, and he even says like because of some other things that Jim Mickle was doing stylistically, everyone immediately goes to Carpenter, you know, on the score. Which was my first thought when I saw the movie. I was like, that's such a cool John Carpenter throwback score. And this was maybe 2 years ago before most low budget genre movies were doing John Carpenter synthesizer scores, which they're all doing now. So I was fascinated to learn that, he didn't sit down to write that. He just wrote.
No, he wrote all those melodies and stuff on other instruments. And then they decided to apply synthesizers to it, and then the Carpenterness of those scores kind of emerged,
right?
But it was never that intention. I was joking. I saw him recently we were talking about that score, and I was like, yeah, you just need that like that Carpenter preset on the keyboard and then it's just like it instantly becomes John Carpenter.
Well, and that's it. I think there's like in After Effects, there's like some sort of Carpenter filter now that a lot of filmmakers are just putting their movies through because we're seeing a lot of you know, homages, sometimes just outright imitation of Carpenter, from the lighting to the photography to the music, especially. How do you feel about that when you hear as many current scores now that are kind of like aping stuff from 30 years ago?
Well, you know, I have this thing where I feel like it's this weird filter, and I don't know if I'm always right about it, but I always feel like I can get the sense of, for me, it's like the material either rings true to me or it rings false, in that it's either a really loving homage by somebody that truly has a passion for it, or it's somebody that thinks it would be cool to do that.
right.
You know, and some of the stuff, I have to admit, like some of the stuff I hear, and it's like I giggle to myself because I'm so joyous about it. You know, like I saw years ago, I saw like the American premiere, because it just happened to be in the city around Halloween time, of the remake of Maniac, the one with Elijah Wood.
Yeah.
And for someone who like absolutely loves the original Maniac and loves the original Maniac score, of course, like I walked into this movie like completely, you know, skeptical, and it's all through the POV. It's all POV. It's right. It's a, you know, it's a gimmick movie. And I have to say, that movie opened and it's like him driving around in a van, kind of talking to himself, kind of like to a woman walking on the street, but to himself. And there's this very like 80s synthesizer score. And it was like, this feels like an 80s Michael Mann movie to me. And I am totally on board. Like, I came into this movie ready to be like, fuck this movie. And now I'm like, and instantly I'm like, okay, you know what? You piqued my interest. I'm going to go on this ride with you.
Yeah.
And I ended up really liking it. And then, of course, you know, It Follows is the big one now. I recently did a thing with Jeff Grace and Larry Fessenden, who wrote the foreword to my book. And he was talking about – Larry was telling us about how – the thing about Larry is that he knows everybody. I mean, he's kind of a brilliant filmmaker on his own, but he's a producer and he produces all kinds of things, not horror movies, but he also just knows everybody. And so he was saying that he's talked to other people and everybody is temping. Like I think he was talking about like a film festival, people that he knows that work at a film festival. And so all the submissions came in and everybody was temping their music, temping their film with the It Follows score. So, but to me it was like that, you know, like that movie, I heard that score. And again, it was like, it put a smile on my face. Now I know it's happening a lot more, and maybe in other circumstances, you know, I'll either get tired of it or, like I said, something won't ring true to me about it. Like pretty soon, it'll feel like I'm just doing this because this is what people do now.
Right.
And then I'll be like, this is shit. But so far, from what I've heard, I've kind of been really pleased with hearing this kind of music again in movies. You know, even like Drive. Is that the name of the movie with
Ryan Gosling?
Yeah, like that score, or even like when that Tron Legacy came out, like
that was a cool score. That score was the best thing about that movie.
To me, it was like that movie again. I equated to like all that stuff driving around on his motorcycle. Like I was like, this is a fucking 80s Michael Mann movie. I am into this. Like a thief or something's going on here. I'm into this. Okay, let's do it.
If Thief got sucked into a computer and found now his dad had been there for 30 years.
I would watch a movie where James Caan gets sucked into a computer.
Yeah, I would too. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm still – I was writing earlier today. I was working on a review of a movie that's coming out, I think, later this year called Beyond the Gates, and it's very much kind of that 80s throwback thing, and I – Open the review by talking about, like, I think we're reaching, you know, peak nostalgia where, like, at this point I can't even tell, is this good anymore or is it just pushing my buttons because I like, you know, when I watch Stranger Things, I'm like, do I even like this show or do I just like 80s kids on bikes and this score? Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, or is this just a collection of shit I like? Right. So it totally pushes my buttons, but I, at this point, I've lost my way in the woods. Like, is this good? I can't tell. I just like the things that it's referencing. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's another one. I mean, for instance, I mean, I don't want to – I'm not going to put down a movie, but a movie that a lot of people love a lot that I particularly didn't care for was Donnie Darko.
Okay.
And to me, personally, I know a lot of people love it, but to me it rings false. Whereas then I watch a movie like House of the Devil by Ty West.
Yeah.
And that's like totally like this homage to a very specific thing. And there's like, you know, rip off 80s music at the beginning of it. But like, I watched that movie and I'm like, this guy fucking loves this. Like, he wanted to make this movie about his love for this kind of movie.
Yeah.
And like, as, and even though that movie's flawed or whatever, like, it's like, it, its heart is in the right place.
Yeah.
And like totally on board for something like that. Whereas with Donnie Darko, I just didn't feel like its heart was in the right place. I don't know why, what it was about it. But for me personally, it's just like it didn't ring true to me. It was more, it felt to me, it felt more like a guy who was trying to make something cool than a guy that was trying to really make something that he loved. And I obviously could be completely off base with that, but that's the feeling I got from it. And so like I use those two movies as an example of like something ringing true and right. For me it's ringing false for me.
Was there,
I think something like Stranger Things, to me it feels like it rings true. Like it doesn't feel like we're just going to sit in the 80s because, you know, people love the 80s right now.
It doesn't seem born out of sitting, like it seems like the filmmakers or the showrunners, whatever. It definitely feels like they did it because they love all that stuff, because they grew up reading Stephen King and watching Spielberg movies and stuff. I start to doubt my own responses to it. It's not even that like I think the show is bad or that they've done. It doesn't seem cynical, but I'm just at the point where I'm like, I don't. Am I just programmed to respond to stuff? You know.
Pavlovian.
Right, exactly. Did you see Turbo Kid from last year?
I did not. That's okay. The one with Michael Ironside?
Michael Ironside is in it, yeah. It's like this crazy French-Canadian movie that Michael Ironside plays the villain. And like I love every single thing about it. And it was like somebody opened up my brain and was like, okay, this score and this kid riding a bike and this crazy gore and, you know, there's like a Laserdisc joke at the beginning. Every single, the opening logo looks like the Canon Films logo. I'm just like, they made this movie just for me. Right. Yeah. Now, is it any brain. Right. But like, is it any good? I've lost sight of if it's actually any good, or is it just like, well, this is all, it's like you took all your favorite foods and threw them into a bowl and ate them all at the same time. It's like, it's probably not actually good, but because you like all that stuff, you're like, I'm happy eating M&Ms and pizza together.
I think for film fans, and I think some listeners, some of your listeners will get this and some may not, but for me, there's always been this, there's a difference between, do I like it or is it good? You know, like,
yeah,
I like a lot of things and some people are like, well, if you like it, then it's good. And there definitely is that argument, but there are things that I love that I would never argue with somebody that they're good. But in a way it's true. If you do connect with it, it's doing its job.
Right.
And so in that way it's successful.
Right.
So, If you love it, then, you know, how bad could it be?
That's true. Was there anyone that you really wanted to get for the book that that you were unable to connect with?
Yes. And I always try to answer this question with a little bit of reservation because I don't want it to seem like I would have rather had these people instead of the people I had.
All right, let me phrase it this way. If you were going to do a volume 2, who might you reach out to?
Well, I would, to me, the person, I talk about Carpenter being the guy where I'm like, if I don't get Carpenter, it's not worth doing this. To me, if I don't get Howard Shore, there's no point in doing a volume two.
Okay. Yeah.
I also think talking to Richard Band would be really cool.
Like, yeah, I totally wanted to ask you about Richard Band. Yeah. Kind of how you felt about.
And he actually was somebody that I just never got through to. Sent emails to email addresses that I found. Had I known then what I know now, which is that all these guys know each other and are friends, I maybe would have been able to just ask like one of the guys that I interviewed that I got particularly along well with, like Harry Manfredini or Alan Howarth, or it's like, hey, can you hook me up with Richard Band? And they probably would have done it, but at the time I didn't realize that like they literally all know each other. Like they get dinner sometimes together and stuff. So Richard Band would have been great. I'm not the the Full Moon stuff, I have a lot of nostalgia for that kind of stuff. And Stuart Gordon, who amazingly wrote a blurb for the back cover of my book. There are some of his movies that I just absolutely love, like From Beyond and Castle Freak.
Yeah.
So I would have loved to talk to Richard Band and Howard Shore. So those are definitely some of the first guys that I would probably try to contact if I was to do a volume two. I would love to do more foreign guys. The problem is sometimes you run into a language barrier, which right. I did run with the Italian guys, but I would love to kind of open that scope up a little bit more and talk to, you know, hopefully maybe talk to like a Japanese composer or I'm kind of blanking on his name, but the guy that did like The Orphanage, I would love to talk to him. There's a lot of guys. Believe me, there's more than enough people for me to talk to for a volume two. I don't have a formal list that I've started writing down people, but there are always composers that I've always like, oh yeah. Like if I do a volume two, I should should interview that guy. Harrison, is it Jim or John? I'm blanking on his name. The guy that did like Creepshow.
He was like an editor too, right?
He was like the second unit director and he's directed his own stuff. I would love to talk to him too. He was someone that's coming at it from a different, you know, he had other jobs on those films and then just did them. And then also did the music.
Right. John Harrison.
John Harrison. Yeah. Those are the, like Howarth. Howarth's the bulk of Howarth's career in movies is actually with sound design and sound effects and stuff. And so like I love that his interview is so much about that, because it's like, how does sound work in movies in general? So I think, you know, talking to Harrison would be great, because you'd also be getting the perspective of someone who that's not his first job on a movie, is not the composer. Just to get like different, again, to me, it's about the diversity of perspectives and styles and stuff. And so those are some of the guys that I would love to talk to if I did a volume two. And it's not something, and it's definitely, it is definitely something that I've thought about, but my publisher, I think wisely, has said like, let's wait to see how this one does first.
Understandable. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right, so let me ask you this. Do you have a favorite Carpenter movie and or score?
Well, I guess I'd have to say my favorite John Carpenter movie is The Thing.
Okay. Mine too, but yeah, he didn't write the score for that one. So
score is tough. I love a lot of his scores. I mean, I think probably my three favorite Carpenter movies are probably his Apocalypse Trilogy or whatever it's called. I love Prince of Darkness.
Yeah.
I talked a lot about it in The Mouth of Madness already. I love the score of Prince of Darkness. And I also, you know, I can't pick a favorite score because I love The Fog. I love the score to The Fog, and I think a score of his that is totally overlooked is Christine. I love the score for Christine.
I've just recently kind of started listening to that one and kind of familiarizing myself with it, because that's one of his movies that I've seen less than a lot of the others. But I've been listening to Christine a lot lately.
I think that movie gets the music. You don't think about the music as much in that one because there's so much like popular songs. There's so many popular songs in that movie. It's very much like a soundtrack movie because those songs used brilliantly as the voice of Christine. So there's all this like old rock and roll and then like 80s takes on old rock and roll songs. So I think that's the music that we remember bad to the bone, you know, when we remember like, you hear me knocking, but you can't come in,
right?
You know, but yet we don't really remember the score so well, but I think that score is totally underrated. And that's one of his best scores to me.
I'm trying to think of another favorite. Do you have like a favorite Fabio Frizzi score?
I think his best is probably The Beyond.
Okay.
But because my introduction to it was Zombie, that'll always hold a special place in my heart. Yeah. And because of that rock opera tribute.
R.O.K. In October, Fabio Frizzi is coming to the Music Box Theater in Chicago and they're screening The Beyond, and he's playing live. And I'm dragging my wife, who has never seen a Fulci movie ever, and I keep telling her, like, well, you're not going to be into the movie, but that's okay. We're going, you know, you'll just enjoy the experience having kind of the live accompaniment and stuff. But they're billing it as the composer's cut, and I don't know if that – is that a different edit of the movie?
That I don't know. I know it's something that he's been working on for the last few months because he's been, like, teasing things, like, on Facebook and stuff of, like – showing him like in an edit room with like The Beyond up on the screen. So I don't know. Maybe he's just redone the score for it. I have no idea. It seems crazy if he actually recut the movie. I can see him maybe, you know, doing things with the score that he maybe wasn't able to do the first time, you know, pulling a Lucas on the score for the movie, but I don't know. That should be fun, man. He played in Philadelphia last year, and my brother lives down there, and my brother owns a couple of music venues and runs a couple of music venues down in Philadelphia. He doesn't run the one that Frizzi was playing at. But so I texted him and I said, how far is this place from the bus station in Philadelphia? He's like, it's not far, but it's not a good neighborhood, so I wouldn't walk it if I were you. He's like, why? And I was like, because I want to come down and see this show. And so he asked, like, are you coming down with your like a friend or something to see this? And I said, no, I can't. I don't know anybody that would want to get on a bus and go to Philadelphia to see Fabio Frizzi. And he's like, I'll go with you. So he went. And as we're walking into the venue, he asked, so what is this guy's score that I know, that I've seen? And I said, nothing. I haven't seen anything that this guy's done. And so we went. We watched the show. You know, there's no seats. We stood and he came. Fabio comes out, plays the show. My brother's like standing behind me, leaning up against a post or, you know, something. And so the show ends and I was in heaven and we're walking out and I have no idea what my brother thinks of this. You know, it's not the kind of music that he would listen to certainly on his own. And so we're walking, we leave the venue and I just said to him, I said, So what did you think? How, you know, did you like it? And he just turns to me. He's like, I loved it. He's like, it was fucking awesome.
That's awesome.
And I was like, oh, thank God. Like, I really had no idea what he was going to think of it. Like, it really could have gone either way. And luckily he was way into it. He was starting talking to me about it. He's like, you know, what I like about it is it's like not the kind of music I would expect for a horror movie. And I was like, yeah, well, those Italians, they don't really adhere to that kind of convention a lot. So I'm excited that you're taking someone that doesn't know it. It would be interesting. I mean, obviously, it'll be a very different experience than I had. One, I'm sure my brother's different than your wife. And two, you'll be watching a movie with accompaniment. And I just saw a concert. But I think it's I don't know. For me, it's always a lot of fun to go to see these things with people, because then you kind of get to relive it through their eyes in right. other ways. Or ears, I guess I should say.
Well, yeah. So, or both, you know. With the Frizzy show, when he did the concert, was it like the Carpenter thing where he had like clips showing, or was it just music?
No, it was so far everybody I've seen that has done this kind of thing has they play clips.
Yeah.
You know, maybe not necessarily like scenes or anything, but you know, film clips, kind of just a montage of stuff playing behind them.
I one of my great regrets of the last few years is Alan Haworth came. He was at a horror convention, and I sat down to see him essentially do that, you know, play some of his music with kind of a multimedia presentation. But he was having so many technical problems, and it wasn't him. It was the venue. None of his clips were working and the lights were off and it was late. And I was like, I gotta go. And so I didn't, I saw him play live a little bit, but I wish I could have seen the whole show, but I bailed because I just lost patience with the technical problems.
Yeah, I have yet to see Alan. I would love to see Alan play live. Unfortunately, he ended up playing here before I started the book, and I didn't know about it. Even before I had started the book and really was into the idea of doing this kind of thing, I totally would have wanted to see him, but I just didn't know about it. I was lucky enough to, you know, he came to the signing that I had on Sunday.
Yeah.
And we, a few of us went out to dinner after, and I was telling him, I said, if you ever come back to New York, I was like, to do this, I was like, let me know. And he started talking about how he did it somewhere, and he had a band with him, like some like local band backed him up. And I said, Alan, you come to New York, I will put together a band. Like I will put together a group of guys that will back you on this stuff. He's like, okay. He's like, I'll let you know if somebody comes calling from New York. He's like, I'll let you know. So I don't know, in some crazy alternate universe, or maybe sometime in the future, there might be a crazy show where I might be emailing you and saying, I'm going to be playing with Alan Haworth.
Yes. I will be on a bus to New York to check that out. Or just insisting that you guys tour. Just take that show on the road. How's it going with Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers?
It's going well. You know, the problem with that show, doing that show, is that we only are able to get together to do it every other week.
Yeah.
And so we can't cover as much ground as we'd like to. And with so few choices and so many great movies, it can be hard to figure out what we're going to do. But we're coming up on our year anniversary. Our 2 year anniversary is coming up.
That's awesome.
And, it's been fun. It's given, you know, to people that listen to the show, I mean, they know that Dion and I have been friends for a very long time. And, you know, as happens when you become adults, you sometimes start to lose touch with friends and stuff. So this, as much as it would be nice, and I wish we could get together and not do a podcast and just hang out sometimes, it has given us an excuse to see each other and text a whole fucking lot. way more than we would definitely had we not been doing it. So it's been a lot of fun. We just had our weirdest sleepover ever, where we did the weirdest Saturday Night Movie sleepover movie, which is we did Cruising.
I was going to say, was this Cruising? Because I never watched that at one of my sleepovers.
And it was funny, it didn't even occur to me until like we're watching it, and I'm just like, this is not the kind
this
of movie
is not a sleepover you... well, a different kind of sleepover, I guess.
this is like that sleepover gone wrong. Guys, I read it in a movie.
I thought we were gonna watch He-Man. Why is everyone dressed like this?
Why is he moving up his hand with Crisco? You know, that's the that's one thing that we struggle with is staying to the formula of the a traditional what most people would think of a sleepover movie and longing to talk about other kinds of movies too.
Well, but so. Don't you feel like the longer the show goes and the more your audience is familiar with it or on board, I mean, you start to kind of have that freedom to just like, okay, yeah, it's not a sleepover movie, but you know us and you know how we talk about movies, so you can listen to us talk about Cruising, you know, where you kind of are able to like branch out. Like in the early days of our site, when I would write stuff, I would like brand everything with F in front of it. And now I just get such douche chills where I'm like, why the fuck did I do that? Cause I thought I had to early on, you know? And I'm like, no, yeah. Nobody cares. It's fine.
Yeah.
So you are, you know, you do get kind of maybe hopefully some more freedom to kind of branch out.
Yeah. I mean, we've always done it a little bit and, so, I mean, yeah, it's fun to branch out. I mean, to me personally, I could talk about, you know, I could just talk about Karate Kid, you know, every episode. But, but Dion gets a little bored with it sometimes.
There's not a single leather bar in the Karate Kid. When are we going to get to Cruising, damn it?
So, you know. It was, you know, honestly, we were trying to think of like, obviously we both live in New York and it's the summer and we've been wanting to do like just a very New York movie. And, you know, there's a lot of sweat going on in Cruising. So oddly enough, that was our thought process, but we came very close to doing the Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, which is also not a sleepover movie, but a movie that we both love a lot. And, yeah. So we'll probably get to that one at some point.
I assume you're referring to the Tony Scott remake.
Well, it'll get mentioned.
Because John Travolta's character in the Tony Scott remake is really straight out of Cruising. Like, he really walked right off the set of Cruising and onto the Tony Scott
remake. True, I didn't really think of it that way.
Yeah. Thank you guys again, too, for submitting. You guys did a very nice, very funny kind of greeting on the podcast-a-thon that was very well received. So thank you guys for sending that. As soon as I was like, oh, that might be fun to have like some other podcasts that we're friends with, you know, send in some messages, and you guys were the first people I thought of, and right away you were like, yeah, sure, we'll put something together. So thank you very much for doing that.
The biggest problem with that is like I had no idea like what it was you really wanted.
You know, I didn't either. I was just like,
and as I was listening to the podcast, I thought I was hearing like other people's. I was like, oh, we didn't do that. Like, I wonder if we should have done that.
No.
It's like, we really just gave you like a 5-minute version of the show. And, well, I'm glad it went over well. I mean, you were nice enough to tell me when you emailed me to thank me that, for doing it, that it seemed to be well received. So that was nice to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So let me give you a chance to plug everything. The book is for sale now, like pretty much wherever you can buy books. Yes.
I believe so. Yeah. It's definitely on Amazon.
Okay.
So, I mean, if worst comes to worst, you can find it there.
And I'll just put a link to the, you know, you can click right through on this podcast post where people can go right through and buy the book. And hopefully everyone will, not just because it's an awesome book for anybody who's into horror movies, which I know a lot of our listeners are, but just to support somebody who's been a friend of the show for so long. But in addition to buying the book, which everyone should do, where can people find you online?
Well, both I have a Facebook page and a Twitter account for the book, which is just @ScoredToDeath. And I don't really have anything scheduled yet, but like I just did the signing. So when things like that pop up, that's probably where you're going to be able to find out about that stuff if you're interested in coming out. Like I just did my first horror convention also as a vendor, which was kind of an interesting and fun experience selling the book. So I'll be doing more of those. And so that's for the – that's really – right now that's – the best place to find out about the book. And then the only other thing is the Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers, which is our podcast, and we have a pretty active Facebook community. So in terms of, you know, there's discussion there. People like to contact us, and there's a lot of it's more like a kind of a discussion forum than just like hanging out at our, you know, checking out our Facebook page. So it would be great if you're interested in that kind of thing. People could come there. They also have, we also have a Twitter account, which is @SatSleepovers. And then the website is SaturdaySleepovers.podwitz.com. And of course, you can get the show on iTunes and Stitcher and all those kinds of things.
And do you know yet what your next episode is going to be? How do you follow up cruising, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, let me think. We already recorded the next one.
Okay.
So that
you don't,
one.
Yeah, you don't have to spoil it here. I'm not trying to. And,
I will say it's from the 90s.
Three Ninjas. Got it. Three Ninjas.
And it's another sweaty movie.
Three Ninjas Strike Back. Got it. Okay.
And then I don't know. I'm trying to think what we have. We know what we're going to do for our anniversary, which is going to be our second show of September. It's going to be our big 2-year anniversary spectacular. And it's going to be a very fun movie that both Deanne and I have a great affection for. So I hope everybody will tune in for that one. Our last anniversary, as I think you guys were nice enough to plug, was last September. We did 1989's Batman.
Yeah.
Which was epic. It's like 3.5 hours long.
there's a theater near me that's doing some repertory shows, and that's one of the movies coming up. So I'm going to take my son, who's 7, and it's going to be his first time seeing Batman. So I'm kind of excited about that.
That's awesome. Our big thing for that one, and we'll still get messages from people that I've had just listened to it, which is like, we ate 1989 Batman cereal. So we ate like 30-year-old cereal for that episode. I found an unopened box of Batman cereal at a convention somewhere. And needless to say, it was disgusting. And thank goodness we didn't get sick.
How are you going to top that on the 2-year anniversary?
Yeah, I don't know. We're going to get matching tattoos or something. I'm not sure yet.
I like that. I like that. Well, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time out to talk to me. It was a ton of fun talking about the book and just getting to talk about horror and movies and all that stuff. I'm a fan of the podcast and just a fan of you guys. So it means a lot to me that you would come on and talk.
Totally. Likewise, man. I mean, I enjoyed your podcast before you enjoyed our podcast.
So. Oh, I see how it is. I made you, you made me first, I believe is the translation there.
I love the site and the podcast. So I was thrilled when we kind of talked about me coming on to do this. I want to do at some point, we will get the technology where we can do this, and I want to have sleepovers with guests. So maybe someday Patrick will come to a Saturday night movie sleepover.
I would love that.
Have you guys had a bucket of pizza?
Have you guys done cruising yet? Because I was thinking about doing cruising.
We could always do another cruising episode. there's so much more to discuss.
What if, and I'm just spitballing here, what if you start to reframe the podcast and every week or every other week, you guys just rewatch Cruising and that just becomes the gimmick of the show, that just every 2 weeks, hey guys, we're back. We're talking about Cruising.
But we have to have like someone new. Preferably who hasn't seen Cruising would be the idea. Like, what is Cruising? Just, it's Al Pacino. You'll love it.
You've seen The Godfather, right? You know, Al Pacino.
There was, we have a podcast. Speaking of, you know, horror and horror music, I did a really impromptu sleepover podcast with Dave, who's gotten a lot of talk on this.
Yeah.
I went to visit him. We did we watched Silver Bullet, which is a movie that both he and I love very much. And so we watched Silver Bullet, and I was like, fuck it, let's start recording a podcast right now. So our first like live sidecast, as we call them, which is a podcast that doesn't involve both Dion and I, and it's not about a specific movie, was Dave and I talking about Silver Bullet. And then, you know, a year later, Silver Bullet's on, and we're both of us happen to be watching it now in separate states, texting. And I was just like, fuck, Dave, we should just do another podcast about Silver Bullet. Music by Jay Chataway, who's in the book. So that full circle.
Nice, nice. I love Silver Bullet. What are your feelings? Because I haven't heard the Silver Bullet episode. On the Silver Bullet werewolf, is it the worst werewolf in a movie ever?
Worst in what way? Like, worse than like it's an awful werewolf, or worse than like that's like the meanest, baddest werewolf?
Like that's an awful werewolf.
In terms of the effects or the lore of a werewolf?
Oh, just the effects. Like I love, and I think it stands out to me more because the I love the movie. I think it's really, really strong. And so the one thing that sticks out about it so much is just that it's weird.
It's like a giant cartoon bear or something.
Yeah, just like a Wile E. Coyote costume that was left in a closet for a long time and eaten by moths. And like, ah, shit, put this on. You're the werewolf.
Yes, I totally get that. But honestly, like, my love for that movie has blinded me to the fact that it was awful werewolf until this very moment.
Oh, shit, I'm sorry. It's like when Roddy Piper makes Keith David put the sunglasses on. It's just like, oh, you ruined the werewolf for me. God damn it.
Yeah, you know, the thing about that movie is it's just there's so much heart in that movie. It's just it's full of heart. Everything from, you know, Corey Haim and Gary Busey's relationship to kind of the beautiful score by Jay Chataway, who I think I jokingly say in the introduction to the book of his music is that, like, I've always said about Jay Chataway's music is he's all heart.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, it's true. And that movie is a prime example. It's like this beautiful, like, love story about a handicapped kid and his sister and his, like, crazy drunk uncle that he loves.
Yeah.
And, it's just it's a beautiful movie that I think it doesn't get a fair shake.
I agree with you, and now I'm like running long, but because now we're going down a Silver Bullet rabbit hole. But I agree with you 100%, and even Jay Chataway's score. Like, I think there's something about that movie that people's cynicism resists. Do you know what I mean? Because it is, like you said, it's all heart. It's like, it's almost borderline syrupy, but like,
yeah,
it has no cynicism, that movie. Like, it's so kind of just gushing with emotion and stuff. And so I think some people watch and they're like, what is this? This is like some sappy TV movie shit. But I'm with you. That's what I love about it. You know, to me, I always call it like, if To Kill a Mockingbird had a werewolf, like, that's what that movie would be.
Totally. And the voiceover.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I don't think. I think.
And she's like, you know, and he says he loves her at the end. And she's like, you know, we couldn't always say that to each other and shit like that. It's beautiful. It's a great movie.
I'm with you.
Go rent Silver Bullet.
Go rent. Okay. Buy Score to Death, everyone. Then rent Silver Bullet. Order yourself a bucket of pizza.
Mm-hmm. And you can hear and you can read Jay Chataway talk about the score to Silver Bullet.
And then listen to the Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers podcast talking about Silver Bullet. Your fucking week is set, everyone. So you're lucky to have us, I guess, is what I'm saying. Well, again, thank you very much. And everyone, buy Score to Death. It's terrific. You're gonna love it. And what else is there to say? Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.